So the only announcement I have is to mention that we're going to have a Sangha hike in on I guess weather permitting on April, I think it's Sunday, April 16th, which is Easter Sunday. And the idea is to have it someplace probably up on one of the open space preserves. We haven't decided where to have it yet. That's some place that's suitable for people, and whether we should do it all downhill or should which is possible, because if it's, you know, you can carpool, you shuttle the cars, and if we start from where I live, which is very, you come up to my driveway and park there, we hike down Wunderlich Park to Woodside, so 5 miles downhill. It's, or to do something which is more open and has spectacular views, like up on Russian, I think it's called Russian Hill, up on Skyline. Or it could be different places. We haven't decided where to do it, but I just thought I'd tell you about this date and this event so you'd have some warning and maybe you can plan on coming. I think it should be a nice event. Go for a hike and then have lunch together. Any other announcements? Yeah, Pesha.
Saturday is the next meeting of the organizing committee at 9:55 at Magnus Miller's house in Palo Alto. Everyone's welcome.
Craig?
Next Monday is the potluck at 6 o'clock up in the front building. Wednesday night at 7 o'clock there's meditation. It'll be in this room. This Wednesday. And anyone who's interested in that workshop on the first on the relationship and spiritual practice, there are flyers on the table.
A few of us are working on upgrading the directory where people, it's like a mailing list or just a way we can contact each other. And on some cardboard out on two chairs out in the foyer is a listing, and anybody here tonight who hasn't checked the list to see if their name is on it and to see if the address and phone number and everything is correct and made a mark to let us know it's all right will save us some time in having to call everybody and see if they want to still be on the list. And if you're not on the list and you'd like to be on the list, on the table there are some forms that you can print your name out and it'll get added on, whatever information you have. And I'd be interested in maybe getting maybe two or three more people to help with calling people. So if anybody's willing to share that task, please see me afterwards.
So this talk I'm going to give this evening evolved a little bit in the thinking about it today. So I don't know what to say I'm going to talk about, except I'll start with a story. And from a Zen story of two wandering monks who were going off to some distant monastery to practice. They were kind of... and they came, they're walking through China on the pilgrimage, and they came close, pretty close to the monastery where they were headed. And they were walking along the river, a little creek that ran right by the monastery. And they were down creek from the monastery. And a single leaf of lettuce went floating down on the creek. And the monks looked down at this lettuce floating away from the monastery and said, "Well, this obviously is not a place for us to practice, since they're so negligent that they even let a single leaf of lettuce kind of wander away unmindfully and unrespectfully of that lettuce. You know, nothing should be wasted. So this is not the place to do Zen practice, so let's go off somewhere else. And so they started walking away, and then from the monastery came running out the cook, and the cook came running down the creek. And huffing and puffing, he grabbed the lettuce leaf and returned to the monastery. And the monk said, "Ah, no, this is the monastery for us." And so a story of, you know, the tremendous respect that it's possible to give all the little details of our life, all the resources of our life. When I was practicing in Japan in the monastery, we were cleaning up from lunch or dinner one day, and in the kitchen sink, when we finished washing all the dishes and pots and stuff, in the kitchen sink, in the drain, was a whole bunch of soba noodles. And the Zen teacher walked by and saw the soba noodles there and got very upset that they were kind of being discarded in the sink. So he put them all in a bowl and ate them. Because nothing should be wasted. Or the Zen master Dogen, there's a story of him that when he took water from a river, took his bucket full, I don't know what he did with the water, but he'd take a bucket full of water and he'd use half of it for himself. And the other half of the water, he'd return to the river, out of respect. And when he returned it, he'd always pour it towards himself, with some feeling that's the most respectful way of returning water to the river, I guess. You know, just dump it carelessly out into the stream. And then there's another story of that Gary Snyder tells when he was in Japan. Of his Zen teacher noticing a pair of discarded or tossed away chopsticks, wooden chopsticks, and the Zen master being somewhat upset about these, and picked up the chopsticks and said, "In throwing these chopsticks away, you've taken away the life of the chopsticks. You've killed the chopsticks in some kind of way." And then Gary Snyder goes on, this essay that he wrote, to say, well, in kind of nowadays we understand that it's not just simply killing the life of the chopstick and throwing it away, but also in throwing away the chopsticks, you're killing the rainforest, since many of the chopsticks in Japan come from the rainforest in the Philippines. Some of them come from Oregon. The Japanese use something like 30 billion wooden chopsticks a year. So there's a tremendous amount of wood that goes into the chopsticks. So there's a value in Buddhism, a tremendous value in Buddhism, put on first simplicity, living simply, living contently, but also living respectfully of all the resources that we have, respectful of the earth, of the air, of animals, plants, that we share the planet with. And as I said on Saturday, the Buddha once was asked to give the kernel of his teaching by someone. And his response of giving a kernel of the teaching was to say that, he said, don't cling to anything. With the idea being that if you practiced not clinging to anything at all, you'd have all of Buddhism right there in your hands. You don't have to really receive any other teaching or do any other practice, and simply relinquishing all clinging. And the motivation and the understanding of the value of not clinging can come from two sources, and one is a personal source, and that is that you can understand it as that when you cling, that the psychological motion of clinging is painful, actually. The grasping involves in clinging. It's possible to hold on to something without clinging to it, but clinging is like this tight-fisted kind of clawing at stuff. And so there's psychological and physical cost to ourselves in clinging. And often when we realize that cost in terms of stress and pain and illnesses and alienation among our friends, that there's often a natural desire to relinquish it, to let go of it. And I don't know if this illustrates this point too well, but I want to share the story. It's from a book on the AA movement. A few years ago, at an alcoholism treatment center in the suburbs of Chicago, staff members reported an intriguing discovery. Many of them lived at some distance from the facility, each day braving the hazards of tollway traffic and commuting to and from work. Then one day, the state of Illinois instituted an honor system, toll collection booths in that area. No attendant, no barrier gate, just a basket into which motorists were expected to throw their coins. Data are unavailable about how well the method served in meeting the highway department's fiscal and traffic flow needs, but counselors at the treatment center collected observations that soon added up to an axiom. Those who don't throw their money in, their patients don't get well. As one counselor put it in telling the story, how can you pass on an honest program? How can you pass on an honest program if you aren't honest yourself? Honesty is indivisible. I kind of like that story somehow. I don't know if it's true, but how can you do an honest practice, whatever it is? Certainly mindfulness practice requires honesty if you're not honest yourself in the rest of your life. And if you divide up your life between what you think is your spiritual life and what isn't, then it's probably no spiritual life at all. That it has to be somehow, in Zen they talk about a seamless monument, a seamless life. So the first kind of motivation someone can have to give up clinging is just realizing the cost and the consequences for oneself. And the other is giving up clinging out of a wider understanding of the consequences of clinging in wider life, in wider reality. And specifically from an experience or understanding of the interconnectedness of life, interconnectedness of our life with the rest of the world, the earth, the planet, and realizing what the consequences are by our actions, by our clinging in the world around us. And either way, whether you understand it more personally for yourself or you understand it more the external consequences of clinging, either way, not clinging translates to becoming a person with a minimum amount of defensiveness and conflict. Greed, grasping, hate, lust. But also it translates, or it's equal to giving up clinging, is equal to an increased freedom of choice. The less we cling, the more choice we actually have. And as a follow-up of last week's talk on intention and karma, that with increased freedom of choice, there's also that increased freedom of choice translates to increased ability to intend how we act. Intending to act out in a certain way. And I believe that an increased, a diminishment of clinging translates very directly towards an increased feeling of empathy, connectedness, intimacy with the world around us. And that intimacy translates into changed behavior. Translates into how we live our life. In Mahayana Buddhism, they have an image, a metaphor of Indra's net. And Indra's net, Indra is one of the great gods of Indian Buddhism. There's many of them. There's a pantheon of gods that Buddhism basically just accepted because that's what existed around it. If Buddhism had been invented in the West, they probably would have accepted, you know, whatever the local gods were. So there's Indra is one of the great gods. And what?
It would be the internet.
The internet. Indra is next to the internet. That is our god, right? And Indra's net is this net that has a mirror at every junction in the net. And each mirror reflects all the other mirrors in the net. So you find in each corner of the net, in each point of the net, you find all the other points in the net. And that is supposed to be a description of the interconnectedness of life. It isn't simply that things are connected by the strands of the net, but actually in some kind of way, everything contains everything else, to use the kind of cliché. And there's a fair amount of Buddhist teaching, of Buddhist myth, of Buddhist realization that leads or presents an understanding of the interconnectedness between our own state of being, the state of our mind, state of our heart, and that of the world around us. That Buddhism talks a lot about there's a very intimate relationship between consciousness and the external world, that they shape each other, that in the psychological doctrines of Buddhism, mind is considered, or consciousness is usually considered to be primary in some kind of way. So the mind or consciousness or thought in some ways creates the environment. But then the environment then in turn creates the mind. The environment is a kind of a back and forth relationship, reciprocal relationship. And we need to understand the two together, Buddhism says, to really understand the dynamics of change and imprisonment and suffering that makes up our life, much of our life. So what I would like to do this evening is to recount one of the central Buddhist myths or teachings about interconnectedness. And this is a teaching or myth or a sutra which is seldom taught in the West, though it's a lot of people in Asia understand and know the story quite well. It's an important part of Asian culture. And in the selective process in which we Westerners choose and pick what parts of Buddhism we want to relate to, we leave out huge parts which have been important for Asian Buddhists. So one of the early Pali, one of the early Buddhist sutras, is called the Agana Sutta. And the Agana Sutta means something like the origin, the sutra on the origin, something like the sutra of the origins of the beginning. Well, knowledge of beginnings is what it means. Knowledge of beginnings. It's something like the Buddhist creation story. And Buddhists, many Westerners think Buddhists don't have a creation story. But there is a kind of creation story, or a creation myth. And one of the reasons I kind of wanted to give this story is that as the Christian right gets more vocal in the United States about bringing Genesis back into the schools. Maybe that's fine to bring Genesis into the schools, but then shouldn't we have the Buddhist myth in there also, and you know the Japanese myth? You know, who's to say which of these religious stories should be excluded once we start including any of them? And shouldn't the Buddhists be allowed just as much equal time as the Christians? So I thought it would be nice to kind of let people know about this wonderful myth, just because, so we, you know, our ammunition. Maybe that's not a good word. I apologize. Our defense. And maybe it's an important, very important defense. Do a service to our society by offering alternatives. So as I mentioned earlier, Buddhism in India pretty much adopted or accepted the gods that existed in Indian culture at that time. And there was a huge pantheon of them. And though it can be said that the Buddhism itself doesn't really need any gods, that and certainly Buddhist practice, Buddhist doctrine, Buddhist teaching, doesn't require the belief or the understanding or the intervention or the involvement of any of these Indian gods, whichever ones you like. However, they were kind of accepted as just part of nature, because it's very hard for, well, that's just the worldview, was the worldview that there were gods. But the Buddhist view, the Buddha's view of gods was that they were a little bit, he felt a little bit sorry for them. And, you know, it was kind of like second best to be a god. And so the gods usually have a pretty good deal. They're kind of like the Greek gods in some ways, except they didn't argue as much as the Greek gods. But whereas Buddhism kind of accepts the pantheon of gods, it doesn't accept the notion that there's a creator god, that some god created the universe or created the world. And that the world, the universe, in Buddhist and mythological understanding, exists from what could be called natural laws. That the earth kind of is born, the world, the universe, and perpetuates itself through more or less natural laws. However, those natural laws, as we'll see as we go through the sutra, are intimately related to the state of human minds, state of moral conduct of people. There is one god that some Indians in ancient times believed was a creator god, and that was the god Brahma. And the Buddha, in one of his sutras, said, no, Brahma is basically confused about himself. And what happened was, Buddhism kind of, I guess it's not quite the Big Bang theory of the universe, but Buddhism postulates, I think it's the yo-yo theory. Is that one of the alternatives? Where there's a Big Bang and then it comes back again, and there's another Big Bang, kind of oscillating universe. Well, that's the view of the universe that much of Indian religion had, also Buddhism. That there are periods of contraction and expansion. And during periods of contraction, the physical world disappears, and most of the lower celestial realms also disappear. And all the beings of the universe get reborn in what's called, we get reborn as radiant gods, kind of very lofty celestial realms where there's no materiality at all. And they hang out there for a very long time until the next period of expansion begins. At some point, expansion starts again. And when expansion starts again, one of these radiant gods dies, because gods always die. They have lifetimes just like humans do. They're much longer than humans, their lifetime, but at some point they'll die. So when the first of these radiant god dies at the beginning of the period of expansion, he gets reborn in this world system that we're in. He's the first being in this world system. He gets reborn kind of in one of the lower realms of one of the lower celestial realms. And the first one who died and gets reborn is Brahma. Whenever this happens, it's always the same. He's always Brahma. And Brahma looks around and doesn't see anybody. Doesn't see anything at all, hardly. But sees this world with no people. And he gets lonely. So then he wishes, he thinks, wouldn't it be nice if other people were around? He gets lonely and longs for his friends. Soon after he has that longing, some other people are reborn in his retinue. And they get reborn there because there are other radiant gods who have died, and they simply get reborn in the same realm as he did. Well, he thinks that since he had the thought, wouldn't it be nice to have other people around? And then the people appeared, that he created them. And then he had other thoughts about, wouldn't it be nice to have this nice mountains and earth and all these nice, you know, vistas and stuff. And soon enough, because the world is in a period of expansion, all these things happen. But he thinks he created them. And so when these other beings that get reborn, you know, after him, he tells them, oh, I created you. And they don't know any better, so they believe him. And so they go around telling everybody else. And so this whole idea of that there's a creator god, in at least in Indian mythology, comes out of a kind of basic confusion of the first kind of supreme god. So this god, this kind of supreme god called Brahma, is depicted usually as being a kind, compassionate, but a little bit confused person. So Buddhism has this yo-yo theory of the universe. And when things are completely contracted, all the beings are in this radiant heaven. They're radiant gods. So in the Agana Sutta, the Sutra on the Knowledge of Beginnings, it describes that it has one description of this process of how human life on earth comes into being, the evolution or de-evolution or whatever, from being in this radiant beings in some high heaven to coming down to this world. So I'll read you some of it. So the Buddha says, there comes a time when, sooner or later, after a long period, the world contracts. At that time of contraction, beings are mostly born in the radiant heaven. And there they dwell, mind-made, feeding on delight, self-luminous, moving through the air, glorious. And they stay like that for a very long time. But sooner or later, after a very long period, this world begins to expand again. At a time of expansion, the beings from the radiant celestial world, having passed away from there, are mostly reborn in this world. Here they dwell, mind-made, feeding on delight, self-luminous, moving through the air, glorious. And they stay like that for a very long time. At that period, there was just one mass of water, and all was darkness, blinding darkness. Neither moon nor sun appeared, no constellations or stars appeared, night and day were not distinguished, nor months or fortnights, no years or seasons, and no male and female, beings being reckoned just as beings. And sooner or later, after a very long period of time, savory earth spread itself over the waters where those beings were. It looked just like the skin that forms itself over hot milk as it cools. It was endowed with color, smell, and taste. It was the color of fine ghee or butter, and it was very sweet, like pure wild honey. Then some being of greedy nature said, I say, what can this be? And tasted the savory earth on its finger. And so doing, it became taken with the flavor, and craving arose in it. So it's a little bit like the book of Genesis where they eat the forbidden fruit. There's nothing forbidden about this honey. And there's no knowledge you acquire by eating it. But it's the eating of this honey which sets in motion a whole chain reaction of we'll see. Then other beings, taking their cue from that one, also tasted that stuff with their fingers. They too were taken with the flavor, and craving arose in them. So they set to with their hands, breaking off pieces of the stuff in order to eat it. And the result of this was that their self-luminosity disappeared. And as a result of the disappearance of their self-luminosity, the moon and the sun appeared. Night and day were distinguished. Months and fortnights appeared, and the year and its seasons. To that extent, the world re-evolved. So much of the natural world, according to here, started to evolve as a result of cravings, human cravings, or indeed unhuman. They weren't humans yet. They were these radiant beings. And those beings continued for a very long time feasting on the savory earth, feeding on it and being nourished by it. And as they did so, their bodies became coarser, and a difference in looks developed among them. Some beings became good-looking, others ugly. And the good-looking ones despised the others, saying, we are better-looking than they are. And because they became arrogant and conceited about their looks, the savory earth disappeared. At this, they came together and lamented. And when the savory earth had disappeared, a fungus cropped up, in the manner of a mushroom. It was of good color, smell, and taste. It was the color of fine ghee or butter, and it was very sweet, like pure white honey. And then they started craving that and eating that very much. So the fungus disappeared. And then instead of the fungus, then there came creepers, and then bamboo. And then finally there came rice, kind of this worse and worse kind of kinds of foods, more difficult to eat. And then after the creepers had disappeared, rice appeared in open spaces, free from powder and from husks, fragrant and clean-grained. And what they had taken in the evening for supper had grown again and was ripe in the morning. And what they had taken in the morning for breakfast was ripe again by evening, with no sign of reaping. And these being set to and fed on this rice, and this lasted for a very long time. And as they did so, their bodies became coarser still, and the difference in their looks became even greater. And the females developed female sex organs, and the males developed male organs. And the women became excessively preoccupied with men, and the men with women. Owing to this excessive preoccupation with each other, passions were aroused, and their bodies burnt with lust. And later, because of this burning, they indulged in sexual activity. But those who saw them indulging threw dust, ashes, or cow dung at them, crying, "Die, you filthy beast." How can one being do such things to another? I thought of censoring this part. But you get it uncensored. So and those beings who in those days indulged in sex were not allowed into a village or town for 1 or 2 months. Accordingly, those who indulged for an excessively long period in such immoral practices began to build themselves dwellings so as to indulge undercover. Now it occurred to one of those beings who were inclined to laziness, "Well, now, why should I be bothered to gather rice in the evening for supper and in the morning for breakfast? Why shouldn't I gather it all at once for both meals?" And he did so. And then another one came to him and said, "Come on, let's go rice gathering." "No need, my friend, I've gathered enough for both meals." Then the other, following his example, gathered enough rice for 2 days at a time, saying, "That should be about enough." Then another being came and said to the second one, "Come, let's go rice gathering." And he decided to gather enough rice for 4 days, and then another person for 8 days, and so on it goes. However, when those beings made a store of rice and lived on that, husk powder and husk began to envelop the grain, and where it was reaped, it did not grow again, and the cut place showed, and the rice grew in separate clusters. And then those beings came together lamenting again. Then one greedy natured being, then they decided to divide up and have private property, divide up different rice plots, so each person can have their own rice plot. But then one greedy-natured being, while watching over his own plot, took another plot that was not given to him, and enjoyed the fruits of it. So they seized hold of him, and said, "You have done a wicked thing, taking another plot like that. Don't ever do such a thing again." "I won't," he said, but he did the same thing a second and a third time. Again he was seized and rebuked, and some hit him with their fists, some with stones and some with sticks. And in this way, taking what was not given, and censoring, and lying, and punishment took their origin. And then it goes on, and then they decided that things were getting out of hand. And they decided to choose among themselves to have a king. And a king would govern, suppose we were to appoint a certain being who would show anger when anger was due, censor those who deserved it, and banish those who deserved punishment. And in return, we would grant him a share of the rice. And so they went to one among them who was the handsomest, the best looking, the most pleasant and capable, and asked him to do this for them in return for a share of the rice. And he agreed. Some people have pointed out this is a social contract for governing. Everybody gets together and decides who's going to govern them and has a contract of what they're supposed to do. So the basic idea I hope you got from this is that there is an interaction, interrelationship between craving or greed or people's moral conduct and the nature of the environment, the nature of the world around us. So this is a myth. But you don't have to look very far in this world of ours to find that there's a tremendously intimate relationship through history between human greed and human craving and immoral acts, and actually the state of the environment. And most civilizations in the world have passed away because people overgrazed or overfarmed, overutilized the resources around them, abused them in some kind of way. And as I kind of drive around the Bay Area and notice that each year it seems like the smog gets worse and worse, I wonder if it's our version of, first there's water, and the water begins to solidify into this ghee. Are we solidifying with our own kind of form of life that we have here? Are we solidifying our environment in a different kind of way, one that doesn't taste so good? And then in another sutra that talks about the mythic story of these kings that exists in mythological times in Buddhism, it continues the story and talks about how the harmony and the health of the environment and of people is dependent on how well that king governs the people. And in particular, how well he takes care of people. And when a king stops taking care of the poor people, then human life spans, lifetimes, length of time people live becomes shorter and shorter and shorter. And then becomes more and more environmental problems and more social problems. Till finally, the worst of it all, people only live for 10 years. But it was interesting, it starts when the government doesn't take care of the poor anymore. And things start decaying. I think it's kind of, some of these myths, I think, have some kernels of wisdom in them. One Buddhist philosopher said, "The world is created from intentions." And so much of the world that we live in is made from our intentions. And you go to some places like England, and it's almost impossible to find any place in England that hasn't been changed by humans. It's untouched by humans, it's impossible. It's all been cut down and reforested and cut down and changed. A friend of mine came to Tassajara from Holland some years ago. And in Europe, much of Europe is quite crowded, much like England. And you have to go kind of to the Alps maybe to find something that's untouched. And certainly in Holland where it's so crowded. And he came to Tassajara, which is kind of in the middle of the Ventana wilderness area. And he walked away from the central monastery and on top of a little hill and looked around, and all he saw was his untouched mountains. And he started crying because he'd never seen such a thing in his life. So there are places still left where maybe that aren't shaped by our intention, human intentions or human desires or agendas. But it's the world is created from intentions. And he went on to say, the outcome of greed is famine, and the outcome of hate is violence. And how many of us realize that our happiness is to some degree contingent upon the state of our environment? And to what degree is the state of our environment contingent upon the state of our mind, the state of our hearts? From the perspective of awakening, the universe is seamless. It's an undivided whole. And it's only delusion that makes it appear fragmented into infinite number of different parts. And the task of awareness practice, or one of the tasks of awareness practice, is to uncover the lost vision of wholeness and to put the universe back together again. And to think that spiritual development is an isolated activity that takes place in the privacy of one's own being, I think reflects the very delusion of a separate ego that spirituality is trying to overcome. That spirituality is not something that's private. And for many people, when they first start practicing, they practice for themselves, for their own reasons. And I think it should be that way. It's healthiest if it's that way. At some point, as we begin understanding ourselves, understanding the nature of attachments, clinging, aversion, love, compassion, all these things, I think the mindfulness practice opens up naturally to include a sensitivity to the world and the environment and the people around us, the beings around us. And if it doesn't, then I think it's probably not really a real form of spirituality. It's probably using spirituality as a way of strengthening our ego, strengthening our selfishness in some kind of way. I'm reminded that when we do loving kindness meditation, we end it by saying, "May all beings be happy." And when the Buddha talked about all beings, he used the word beings, he didn't just mean human beings. He meant all beings, all living beings, all breathing beings. That our loving kindness gets extended out in all directions to all beings, not just simply even, it's not even just androcentric, or that's not the right word, is it? Human-centric. So just, you know, to save the leaf of lettuce, or to eat the noodles in the sink, or to not throw away the chopstick but use it again, is maybe a form of respect or form of love for the world we live in. And maybe that's enough. So I hope that was interesting to get the Buddhist creation story. That I've thought about it for a few years of telling you the story, but was shied away from it, thinking that it was too bizarre. Oh, today's equinox, coming of spring, and. And I was, you know, today it was raining in my house today a little bit, and I was thinking about this, and how much of the rain is the result of what humans have done to the environment, and maybe here we don't see it so much. I don't know what the global warming has done to El Nino, and you know what's what, but. There are places in the world where human intervention creates monsoons, creates tremendous downpours and storms. Places like Bangladesh, what people have done to the Himalayas and the erosion there causes the flooding, causing to some degree the amount of rain they get in Bangladesh. I think that the impact humans, we all know this, I guess, I don't have to say it, but the impact humans have had on the global scale has been phenomenal. And if we reflect on the origins of that kind of human activity, I think it can all be, most of it, maybe not all of it, but a good part of it can be traced to different individuals clinging to something or other. And maybe if we begin understanding what our place is in the world, there could be another motivation for doing Buddhist practice, rather than just simply being free from our own suffering. We also do practice, we also wake up, we also do mindfulness as a way of contributing to the health of the environment, of the world. Does anyone have any comments? One or two comments? So then my preaching doesn't have to be the last word. Yeah.
Is there a philosophy or a thought in Buddhism that everything that's going on in the world is exactly the way it's supposed to be? Wrong philosophy.
That's to believe that there's meaning to everything, in a sense. I think that's what it means. And Buddhism doesn't necessarily assign meaning to everything. Everything occurs because of conditions. Everything that happens right now is happening because of conditions before it. In that sense, it's supposed to happen, in the sense that... But there isn't any kind of... moral meaning or cosmic meaning or predestined meaning or they would say things exist now because of the way things were preceding it. The former conditions created what's happened now. But once we find ourselves in the present, the future has an infinite number of possibilities.
We
can change the future. Our choices we make now affects how things continue developing from here. So what's happened right now had to happen because all the conditions came together that way. But what happens tomorrow depends in part on the choices we make today.